The Science Basement.
Hello and welcome to the Science Basement podcast, a podcast for those who love all things science. I'm your host for today, Rhiannon.
And I'm your co-host, Sujay.
Today we are talking about textile recycling, a very important topic and one in which I have a lot of personal interest and as a result, a lot of questions.
Our guest today is Anubhuti Bhatnagar, a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Design in Aalto University. She completed her PhD in the field of chemical engineering at Tampere University and then decided to switch fields. And now she's focusing more on the social science side of things. Her postdoc is about researching the social impact of changing sustainability practices in the textile industry. And she'll talk us through about her research today. Hello, Anubhuti, and welcome to the Science Basement podcast. So how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. So let's start the beginning, the outline of why you're researching. Firstly, what is textile waste?
Okay, so...
Big question.
Big question to start with. Yeah. So textile waste, waste is something that is has no value for the one who's owning the product, so to speak. So here, waste for my side of research means that anything that cannot be reused in the textile supply chain. And that would include the clothes that you dispose of, which are damaged. So which have holes in them, which are torn apart, which have some damage due to stains. And all those things are considered waste. There is another classification of waste, which is just like anything that has no use for the for the consumer. So even clothes that are completely fine would be counted as textile waste for you if you just have gotten bored of them and given them away to a charity or something like that.
Yeah, so I guess like following on this definition, personally, I always like to try and buy my clothes secondhand where I can and also try and like put them in these big recycling bins of clothes. Is this are these clothes like then sorted, I guess, into these certain categories of what can be used or what can be resold? And
yeah, so the first step of textile waste is to collect it in one place, then to sort it in terms of what is usable, what is non-usable. The one who's sorting it determines what is usable. So they have their set criteria that if it is a high value garment that can be sold in a better, like we have a second-hand stores that are more vintage items and more luxury items, so it'll go there. If it is a casual thing like a normal jeans and a t-shirt that is not damaged, so it'll be sold in a OOF type of a store. And then there'll be the ones that are not so usable, so they will go to a mechanical recycling or chemical recycling.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you see like 200 denim jackets all lined up, yeah. That's what's happened. Okay, interesting. And in terms of the kind of chemical recycling, if we call it that for this term, instead of to differentiate between recycling in terms of like reusing or reselling the clothes, for the chemical recycling, kind of what materials can be used here, so like can be chemically recycled?
So in terms of the technology development, as far as I understand, it's more to do with the things that are made of single fibers. So like a cotton-rich garment that is like 85-90% cotton may be easier to recycle, or a polyester legging would be easier to recycle than something that is like a jacket, which is made of so many layers of materials. So it has a nylon outer layer, then a down feather filling, then another inside lining, plus the chains, the plastic, the metal. So that is harder to recycle. Yeah.
But we need our down jackets in Finland.
Yeah.
Come on.
No. So the problem is not that you own a jacket. The problem is, do you keep buying new jackets every season? So these products are made to last long. And if you do proper care instructions, then it can last for a lifetime. That's the idea behind it.
So where does the textile waste that like doesn't get into these stores land up? Does everything land up in a landfill or...
So the current statistics is that out of all the waste generated, only 15% of the waste is recycled. Okay. And the rest ends up either in incineration or landfill or being exported to other countries outside of Europe. So that would be like West Africa has a big problem of receiving tons and tons of waste from EU. Then there is the Chilean desert issue that had come up a couple of years back where large-scale products were going from Europe and North America to Chile, and they were just piling up, essentially. Because of, without a sorting process in place, this it just looks like a garbage pile. So
15%, that is awfully low.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I've seen these quite shocking images of clothes, like, kind of, as you say, like, it's like looking like a desert of clothes, or these huge piles just of clothes, which I guess from normal landfill, well, you don't see so many images, but you're, it's not, it's more shocking in a way when it's these clothes that don't look, they still look like clothes. So it's like the, you think they can be reused. And is there like any kind of way, is it at all monitored, or is these kind of like, when I go to recycle my clothes, I don't necessarily know where they're going. Is there any way of monitoring this or doing it more sustainably as a individual in the recycling way?
As an individual, the best thing for you to do is like not buy that many clothes so that you don't need to worry about recycling them. But I don't think that can be controlled by an individual, what is happening at the sorting facility. So that is more to do with public policy. For European Union, I think the public policy is now really focusing on something called extended producer responsibility, which is very much like an ongoing policy for electronics. So whoever is making the electronic has to make sure that they get it back and then they reuse it within the supply chain. But clothes, because they're like a very distributed product, they kind of end up everywhere, and it's very hard for the producer to make sure that it comes back. But because now there is a policy push, people will have to find a way.
Okay. So kind of following on to this, more onto your kind of specific research interests, what is the problem that you're trying to tackle?
So I have only been involved in this textile sector in the last 1.5 years. Before that, I was working on agriculture, which is another big supply chain problem. So some experiences that I've drawn on from that research is you have to look at an entire life cycle of a product. So you start with raw material extraction, then you look at the phases of production, and then you look at consumption, then you look at end of life cycles. So unless you solve the problem at all stages of the life, it's like really hard to tackle it at the end. And that will just end up being in a waste in a landfill. So my idea is to look at the life cycle of textile supply chain.
And by life cycle, you mean also the avoided costs of like children who are employed in these shops who are not going to school, accounting for those sort of things as well, right? This is not just environmental life cycle assessment. So there is a social aspect to it as well.
Yes. So currently I'm working in this project called Textile Recycling Excellence, which is a European Union funded project, which involves 12 partners across the continent. And they're all involved in different stages of this life cycle. So someone is collecting it, someone is sorting it, and the other company is involved in spinning the threads and all those aspects. And my job is to basically do a social life cycle assessment of this new textile supply chain that will involve products made from recycled fibers. So it's not currently operational. That is why we are doing some potential analysis of the kind of people who will be affected. It includes both workers, consumers, and the European society at large.
So it's quite a big scale.
It is.
To put it lightly. Sounds like a very big project, but very important, I guess. I don't know, is it like a new approach to predict these things preemptively? Because I mean, to me, it makes a lot of sense that you would kind of predict what problems might occur later on. But is this, I don't know if you know.
Basically, the concept of life cycle analysis has been ongoing since like 1996. And the first standard for your environmental life cycle assessment came around in 2006. But that only focused on things like carbon footprint, water footprint, acidification.
And is that done kind of afterwards? Or?
That can be done on both stages. So for example, when I did it for my agriculture research during my PhD, it was more to do with, I have done some lab scale research, and what will happen if this lab scale research is scaled up to an entire country? So I can do some potential assessments. So here it's the same thing for social impacts. Also, we are trying to see that what would happen. And just to add to this, that a lot of the analysis is based on the current situation. So there are statistics by International Labour Organization, statistics by all these other waste disposal laws. So they kind of create this hotspot matrix that, okay, these are the problems in this area. So for copper mining, for example, there is a problem in Sierra Leone where the copper is mined.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So then you can also base your collected data on this. So if you're seeing that, yeah, my supply chain seems to not have any social issues when I'm working in India, you can sort of be like, but the government stats say something else. Mm-hmm. So either someone is lying in the data or I am not able to capture the situation through my assessment.
Yeah. So you have to kind of look at the wider, not just focus or not just trust the data that you might collect. It might be on a bit of a wider, which is very different from my field of molecular biology where we have to repeat everything to death to show that it's true. Okay, that's very interesting. And going back to the EU project, it sounds like a very cool initiative and very important, seeing as it involves 12 countries. Is this so solely focused on the EU only then, as it will be involving or like trying to improve these textile recycling? Is it just happening only in the EU, or will it involve wider countries kind of outside of the EU?
So right now, this project does not involve outsiders because it's such a testing that we are basically testing the waters. So we are starting our assessment only from when the consumer has gotten rid of the waste. So we are not thinking of where the waste is coming from, as in what is the primary production supply chain that involves Asian countries and American countries. And so we are focusing only on what is generated in Europe, what can be treated in Europe, and what can be managed within this ecosystem.
So question would be that if the demand sort of goes down in EU because of recycling and general public awareness, wouldn't like that impact the livelihoods of the people in Bangladesh and other, I mean, South Asian countries?
Yeah, so that is one concern. But right now, the kind of overproduction that is going on, we are basically not giving the people the decent working hours, even in those primary supply chains. So if a demand goes down, we can change our working methods and we can provide better working conditions for the people who are doing this manufacturing in Cambodia, India, Bangladesh, and China. Yeah.
But have you had any interaction with such parties or like?
I haven't, but I know other colleagues of mine who do primary research in like Tamil Nadu, where there is a lot of manufacturing going on right now. And then there is Pakistan, where the researchers I know who are working with e-waste, so electronic waste. So they're also talking to recyclers, and there's so much informal recycling going on, so much small scale things that people are doing in their backyards, but might not have the adequate protection needed to do all this work, or do not have access to the protection needed. So reducing demand within the European Union and North America would help create better labor conditions on that side of the planet.
So the European project Textile Recycling Excellence, or T-REX as it's known for short, is focused on making these, breaking down the fibers of the clothes that can't be reused or like fixed or resold, if I understand correctly, and making new yarns currently out of these fibers. And how, or like where in this process does this kind of breaking down of the fibers take place? And is this like a established process currently, or does it need to be further refined?
Yeah, so there are lab scale projects that were done already, and then the technology was scaled up for pilot scale research. And once those were proven technologies, then EU gave the funding to these companies who were involved in the recycling process. So if you look at the website called trexproject.eu, you'll find all the detail about this project. Essentially, we have three kinds of fibers that we are trying to tackle in this work. So there is polyamide, that is polyamide 6, there is polyester, and there is cotton. And all three of them go into making different kinds of garments.
Okay.
So polyamide goes in making outer layers, polyester goes in making our sportswear, and cotton is basically the t-shirt and denims and everything. So the technologies had to be already at a proven scale before we are trying to tackle the continent-wide problem. Yeah, but there are still like problems right now, so we are not able to manage all sorts of wastes basically. Because a lot of garments are blended with multiple things, and then it's a chemical reaction, so
yeah, that's what I was going to ask, because often it's quite hard to find these 100% pure garments these days, at least when I try and find. And even though As I said, I kind of try to buy secondhand, but even like, you know, when you're looking at the care for when you're putting it in the washing machine or whatever, and it says, oh, all these different blends. And I think as soon as you start looking at it, you start noticing more and more that there's lots of different kind of materials in one garment. So I guess this is quite a big problem.
But that's not really like a bad thing, because at the end of the day, you do want your garments to be functional and durable and they have to feel good and last longer. So that's why for at least sportswear, you need to have polyester blended with elastane so that it's a bit stretchy. But it also has to be, there are, and I have only now started learning about the level of finishing processes that go into making these sportswear. They have to be breathable, yet they have to be easy to dry, and then all those functionalities cannot be lost. Just that the people run through these garments very quickly. So yeah, that's where the maybe discussion needs to be, that how do you make people realize that.
And I had also read somewhere that like clothes that are made out of polyamide and polyester should not be put in dryers because they kind of release some sort of, like, I don't know,
microplastics.
Microplastics, yeah.
Polyester seems to, it's been a sort of come to light recently that polyester fabrics, especially made from recycled plastic bottles, tend to release microplastics. So the idea is that the alternate here in Finland that I personally use is to put all the polyester garments in a textile bag, which has it like microplastic safe. I don't know. I've not lab tested it, so I don't know if it works. But yeah, that's my mental note that I try to put all polyester clothes in a separate basket. Yeah. But then the alternative is that if we have a polyester fiber to fiber recycling chain, then we don't need to pull polyester from plastic bottles chain. Okay. So we don't need to mix these two streams.
So the fiber-to-fiber recycling to make this new textile ideally would kind of reuse that polyester that's already used in the original garment.
Yeah, and polyester, the good thing is that it's very, very recyclable. As you can already see from the level of plastic bottle recycling that's happened. So if we as people living in Finland go deposit our bottles in those recycling baskets, and then, it just gets completely fed back into the chain. It doesn't exist in every country, and that is where we should be heading towards, not mixing these two streams.
Yeah, I love the plastic bottle recycling. I mean, it's not just slight tangent. In the UK, we don't have this, and it just makes so much sense. And makes it so much easier to do it because,
And you get that token money out of it. Yeah. So it's like just an incentive to
sure.
buy your next bottle of Coke.
Maybe a different problem. Not for now. Okay, yes, all very interesting and like a very cool scope of the overall project. Is there any other like initiatives in other like countries or things that have been done like on this, on either such a scale or on maybe on a smaller scale that have been looking into a similar kind of multi-country or multinational initiative?
Yes, so actually there is something called, there's a platform called EcoSysTex, which is a European-wide platform that gives you all the information of ongoing EU projects dealing with textile sector, and there are many. And so we are only targeting garments from three of these fibers, but there are other projects that are trying to tackle other household textile waste. So the curtains and bed sheets and the big things, or the textiles that are used in industry. So the Gore-Tex and things that are used in making lining for industrial processes. These are all textiles, the card, the felt material. So there are projects that are dealing with all sorts of textile waste.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the thing you mentioned earlier about like the scale of the process. And even when you were like shocked to find out how much, especially for, as you mentioned, with sport clothes, how much refinement needs to go into the process and how many different levels to the process there is. And I think it kind of reminds me of like, for me personally, I'm vegetarian, and to be honest, I feel like I mention this in every podcast, so I'm not trying to preach, I promise, honestly. But the reason I'm mentioning it now is because, like, I think it's people just are unaware of the level of production that's needed for, like, a simple pair of jeans or something. Yeah. And it's similar with meat, often with these processed meats, or when you know, like, nowadays you don't see, often, especially in, like, the Western world and in Europe, it's very rare that people actually either, you know, catch their own meat or know the process overall. Yeah. And I think it's the same with textiles as well, that everything's so readily available. You don't have to make your own clothes anymore. You don't have to repair anything. So I guess, you know, spreading this kind of awareness or teaching people actually what goes into their clothes might help people think about what they're buying, at least, and reducing the waste in the first place. But I guess this is always quite hard to get the word out there.
And in fact, an interesting thing I recently came across was Patagonia has started this scheme, I think, in which you can get things repaired. And like, if you have a down jacket that's like, you know, needs a bit of stitches here and there, you can send it back to them and they'll fix it for you. And in fact, like all the fashion brands that were telling Patagonia that, okay, this is like a suicide, you know, in a capitalistic economy. Mm-hmm. How are you going to survive if you don't, you know, keep up with the rising demand? I mean, they made much more profits that quarter than before once they started this new initiative. So have you heard of this? I'm pretty sure
Patagonia is sort of considered a pioneer when it comes to creating this reuse system. So, but then there are, Patagonia is not available in every country.
Yeah.
So
beyond
that, quite a lot of brands are now trying to create repair facilities within their stores.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the Finnish Levi stores, I saw that they have this front and center, there's a sewing machine. And
I was going to mention Levi's. I also heard something that, I guess it's probably also linked to repair, but also if you buy Levi's jeans, then they can also like tailor them for you, so it also kind of links into this, like them helping you your jeans last longer in a way or fit you better.
I came across a very interesting statistic while doing some prep for this podcast. Basically, there is so much bulk manufacturing happening that some statistics suggest that only 10% of the garments are actually designed to fit your body. So that leads to immense wastage, because you'll then order something very quickly online and it'll not fit, and then you'll not take the effort of returning
it.
And
slightly evil. I mean, 10% is...
But look at the kind of detergents that we use. I mean, the care instructions for a bottle of detergent, a Surf bottle of detergent, would have the same instructions for the water that is using it, like in India and in Finland. Whereas Finland, you don't need that much detergent because the water is not that, like, heavy.
So there is a bit of a...
You are losing in standardization. You are improving manufacturing by... Yeah. Like tonnage, so you're making so much more, but you're also losing out on style and sense of comfort.
And then the
body images.
Because even for me, like when I look at something online, it very much puts me off having to order anyway. I try nowadays, I don't so much anyway, because I try and be a bit more sustainable. But even if I do, or when I used to do a lot more, then when the clothes come and it's like, okay, this is nothing like what it looked, or the size. It's like, it's just like wearing a tent. And you often see people posting online these funny stories of they ordered this thing thinking it looked like this, and it's either humongous or tiny or, or something. So that's a very interesting statistic for sure.
The fast fashion and then the ultra fast fashion. So there is the consumer has sort of now started becoming one who's ultra sustainable and trying to really look at the kind of clothes that they're buying, and the one who's like, well, the world is coming to an end and I need to buy as many clothes as possible.
I'll have to interrupt. What's ultra fast fashion? I'm an oldie when it comes to these things.
Ultra fast fashion is something that you see in very specific brands, for like Shein and Temu. These are clothes that are super, super cheap. So they're like a dress for $5 or something of that sort.
Okay.
So people end up spending less money to buy a lot more things. But then even the people who are buying it know that it's not going to be of a quality.
But you're going to be wearing it
once and getting rid of it. So So that is ultra fast fashion. And because these companies are so secretive, they don't tell you anything about their processes. So we're still trying to figure out, they can't possibly make people, they can't pay people fairly and yet make these levels of money. So.
And based on these kind of fast fashion clothes, are they, not that this is, I'm not trying to say this in order to justify, but is it easier to recycle these kind of clothes, or is it like exactly the same materials, or is it no difference between it? Is all clothes the same clothes kind of thing?
I don't know. I think it would be even worse, because just the volume that you're dealing with. And if you're making, you're using really low quality raw
materials. That's what I'm thinking, because I was thinking it must be it's designed to be used, as you said, designed to be used once and thrown away in a way. So even if people do reuse it, it's probably going to break quickly. So I guess the materials themselves must be in some way worth lower quality. So I was, this is kind of worth wondering, is it possible to recycle them more?
It can be recycled, but as we already discussed, the technology is not yet developed enough to deal with the volumes that we are making.
Yeah.
So
we
need to
reduce that first. Okay. And going back to the project you're involved in, the T-Rex project, what is your specific role in this project and what kind of data are you collecting or using at the minute?
Yeah, so my role is social life cycle assessment. So for that, I am trying to figure out what is the impact on three kinds of stakeholders is the term that we use. Mm-hmm. So one is workers, the other is the suppliers involved, and the third would be the wider society. And local community and society are two distinctions that we make in this term. So people who are living around a plant that is doing the recycling, and then the wider European society that is benefiting from reduced global warming potential and things like that from the recycling supply chain. So for that, we need to collect data such as doing surveys and interviews with all the 12 partners in this project. And then I'm sort of using secondary databases published for these countries where the plants are set up so that I can verify the evidence collected by the survey. So whether the company in question is performing better than the country average or worse or at the same level. So,
okay.
So, how is it different from environmental life cycle assessment?
So, environmental life cycle assessment doesn't use the term stakeholders. For them, the concern is the environment. And then the categories that they measure are the emissions, pollutants. Mm-hmm. Emissions can be divided into air pollutants. So, the NOx, SOx, PM2.5 and all those things. And then the carbon dioxide. And then there is water. So,
and things like carbon footprint, water footprint, they would be part of
environmental life cycle assessment. Okay. Even the environmental life cycle assessment has there is a technique to convert all of these impacts into something called human health impact.
Okay.
So you can calculate it, but social assessment goes way deeper into it. So it'll talk to individual sectors of people.
So it's more focused on the people involved rather than the kind of impact.
Both the people making the clothes and people getting affected from the clothes. And everyone in between. So
sounds like a very broad, wide range of things that you will be looking into.
It's extremely subjective and collecting data.
But it's not really caught up with the cultural zeitgeist, I guess. Like carbon footprint and water footprint are things that almost every average Joe walking on the road knows these things.
It's not like we didn't include it in the sustainability definition. So the Brundtland Commission definition of 1987 does talk about sustainability has to be for economy, environment, and society. Mm-hmm. So that's why we call it the three pillars of sustainability when we do the research.
Mm-hmm.
So economy and environment are sort of covered because if you don't make money out of it, no one is interested in the sustainability aspect.
Yeah, right.
But another way to look at it is you look at the environment as a whole big circle. Within that is the society. So people are also part of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then within the people sector and the society sector is the economy. Yeah. So you have to look at it like a three-layer cake.
Yeah.
The Stockholm Resilience Center calls it a wedding cake model. So
First
you address the environmental concerns, then you talk about societal concerns, and then you talk about the economic concerns.
Okay. Yeah, I like that metaphor.
Yeah.
The assessment should be done. The assessment should be done for all three.
Definitely sounds like as big of a task as a wedding cake. Not just your average birthday cake, at least. Yeah. So you mentioned, about this data collection, and it sounds like a big scope as I mentioned. What kind of, is there any issues involved in this data collection, I guess, with this kind of more social science aspect of research? It normally has more kind of hurdles in terms of these collecting this kind of data from people and accessing people and making sure is the correct people you're talking to. So have you experienced this what have you done to kind of overcome or?
I am right now currently working on a paper that is exactly trying to figure out what are the challenges that will come up with the social life cycle assessment methodology that I would be using in this project. So because we are trying to still set up the system, I have not started collecting data from my particular system. In general, social life cycle assessment can have challenges such as if you are talking to a worker in Asia, they might not be interested in giving you answers just for the fear of the management. Or a management company might want to hide their data because they don't know what you're asking things for. And despite of non-disclosure agreements between the interviewer and interviewee, there can always be some sort of a veracity challenge. And then there are challenges that you can't just, you just don't know how do you interpret the impact. So what is health and safety for a company? What is important for them? Is it like just provision of PPE equipments, or is it also going beyond PPE equipments to give them insurance policies and teaching them about safety trainings and all those things? So how much information should I ask for as a researcher, and how much information will they be willing to share? There's a gap there. So the solution here is always to do a lot of literature review and try to read existing reports of the kind of challenges that NGOs have reported for a particular sector, and then go into your list of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some people just do an open, unstructured interview so that you can sort of encourage the stakeholders to give it for themselves, that these are the things that are areas of concern for me.
Yeah, so you're not like leading them towards what you think might be a problem and actually listening to what they say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and encourage as many people as possible. So you should talk to workers, talk to managers, talk to suppliers, talk to society people, talk to local communities. It takes a lot of time.
So postdoc research has been a bit challenging, I guess, because from what I understand is you're a chemical engineer, right? Yeah. So you probably dealt with a lot of quantitative data in your PhD. And now your data is more qualitative, I suppose, right?
Yes. Yeah, I have help because I'm working in a department of design where there are all of them are qualitative researchers primarily.
Okay.
So there is a lot of back and forth discussions constantly going on because... But then my background also helps because I try to boil it down to numbers. So you can also... It's sort of the chemical engineering has helped in this sector.
Yeah.
And what made you want to do this switch? Because it's very interesting that... I think like it would help at least in these kind of fields where you have... Where there's the science and the society overlaps. I mean, in all fields, but in some fields definitely more than others. And especially in this where you have these chemical processing plants, which is obviously very hardcore... chemical engineering, and then the society impact that it might affect even the workers themselves or the, you know, local area, as you mentioned, but also the bigger scale. What kind of made you want to do this switch?
Basically, just the fact that it's more challenging.
Okay.
And because I've done environmental life cycle assessment during my PhD, I sort of understood that this data collection and input-output analysis for various processes can get very murky and very difficult. And then to add to that, just the factor that social analysis is in general something I've not done before. And postdoc is sort of the right time if you want to experiment.
You can try, yeah.
Yeah, because initially I had a one-year contract. So I was always like, I had the safety net of going back to my biomass.
Yeah.
And chemical stuff. Yeah,
it's really nice to hear because I'm a PhD student, so I'm not near finishing. But it's always nice to hear people's experiences. And I guess it reminds you that you're not... You're not stuck where you are if you want to try something new. So that's,
I have the safety net of the fact that I don't have to, my visa doesn't depend on this work. So
Yeah, that always helps. And so now we kind of discussed the issues or the problems with such a project, but to switch it on to like the lighter note or the more positive side and kind of take a step back from this project specifically, how have such initiatives or kind of policy development like the one you mentioned or multiple ones you mentioned in the EU changed the fashion brands themselves and their approach to producing clothing, or have they at all yet?
Yeah, so this current project that I'm working on is completely led by textile companies because they have been in constant discussion with the EU policy makers and then constantly getting an idea of what we want, what they want from the companies and what the companies want from the policies. So this direct discussion has sort of helped, and we as a research organization are just out there helping these two parties meet and figure out something that will be more sustainable approach to making clothes and creating better garments essentially for everyone. Yeah, so the policy helps the companies. It has to be sort of a push
from the top. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Otherwise, there's always a way to to use the word chicken out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I know you're vegan, but...
It's all right. And yeah, I guess this linking to like back to the fast fashion that we talked about earlier and these companies that maybe aren't so transparent or aren't so willing to drive the change or, you know, listen to the change. And I understand this is mostly outside of the EU, so it's not necessarily involved in this policy.
But like... Do you think that a top-down approach is the way to go always? Or like, how can we make sure that, because, you know, top-down policies generally are a little unsustainable, I think, in the long run?
Yeah, but it's not really top-down, as in it's an existing problem that people have been highlighting. People who live in these communities who face all this European waste have been saying that we don't want your waste, so do something about it. So it's just that the companies were not looking at that problem, which is what, so it was sort of driven by the people to the policymakers and then pushed down. It's not like the EU people in Brussels decided suddenly one day that, oh, we have too much textile waste. It's something that was becoming a problem slowly and steadily, and it's still increasing. The waste is still increasing. We are nowhere near addressing the problem yet. We're just trying to do something to change the whole system. Mm-hmm. So that by 2030, maybe we'll have a new way of making clothes. So, yeah, that's the idea of the project. And it's led by Adidas, so it's...
Okay,
like,
yeah. And actually, this kind of has just brought a new buzzword, let's say, to my head, which maybe you don't know much about or how it affects this, but the term greenwashing is very often used. And it's very interesting that you mentioned that these companies are actually doing or... you know, leading such a project as this EU-based initiative, and the textile companies themselves are trying.
Yeah.
And I guess in this sense, like these buzzwords like greenwashing, and even myself, as I said, I try to buy sustainably.
Mm-hmm.
When you see words like this, it's very hard to sift through, is this initiative that they're doing actually helpful or not? Yeah. Or is it just to make them look... like they're trying to be sustainable. I guess in your case, then, it is very useful. It sounds like really in kind of at the forefront of the field. Is there a way, like when you see such buzzwords as greenwashing, or even you see an initiative itself, like you walk into a shop and see, you know, either this product is completely recycled, or, you know, maybe they, oh, we're launching this new green range or something like this, or we're funding this. Is there a way to like know if this company is doing actually good things as a consumer?
So there are things that a consumer can do. First of all, don't impulse buy. So just look up the things that you're interested, the brands that you're trying to buy from. And there are sustainability indexes, there are transparency indexes. I think it's either Refashion or Remake has one. There is a Good On You website which rates all the brands on different parameters of sustainability, so water footprint, labor practices and all those things. So you can do some sort of a research. At least within Finland, it's very easy to do that because these are brands that are on those websites. Maybe some small or medium enterprises might not be listed on those companies on there yet, but their websites would have some information. So if a website does not have any clear instructions on who's making the clothes and where they're sourcing material from, maybe you can avoid that website.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And there are companies that if you look at their main websites, they will have their CSR policies, so corporate social responsibility policies, and things that they are going to be able to declare. So H&M is not considered a very good green brand, but they do score high on transparency because they do report a lot of the places where they make their clothes from. So they are trying to change.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so they maybe were previously more...
Yeah, previously problematic. Now trying to...
Thanks. I was like, how do I phrase this in a diplomatic way? Yeah, previously problematic, so they got kind of a bad reputation, and now they're trying to change it, which I guess is where this greenwashing terms comes in. It's a bit of like a blurred line, because, if you were previously problematic, as you said, and now changing, then it could still be seen as greenwashing, but maybe in reality it's still trying to help have an impact on in the positive side of things.
And it also helps that the European Union has created a whole policy that is called Green Claims Directive, which bans the greenwashing. So you cannot... Okay. So there are certain parameters that if your brand does not fulfill, you cannot use certain terms, essentially.
Okay.
So there That's are good. Things on the label yeah. that should be there, and there are things in the material composition that should be declared. And if they're not declared at on the clothes or either on the website or something of that sort, they're still discussing as to how they would create those things. But yeah, there is, again, a policy push always helps.
Yeah, that's good, because it's hard when you read something to know, okay, this is recycled, but is it, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
When you start like looking into things. And I guess in some sense it's good they have these policies, but it's also, or I guess it can be hard to track.
Yeah. So for that, there is something called digital product passport that's under discussion. And that is, I really like that. I don't know how feasible it is going to be.
Yeah.
But it's more like your clothes will have sort of a QR code or a digital marker.
Yeah.
So you can trace the entire supply chain.
Oh.
So you can, from the raw material sourcing to who made it to...
And is that based also in the EU?
So far it's in the EU, but because garments are made across the world, it'll have to include all the supply chains. So that is the challenge. There are national agreements that have to be made.
Wow, that's...
But that's something that is really futuristic, I feel.
Is the US on board?
They might have to be, because Apple changed their ways.
Apple changed their ways. So
Okay, that's super interesting. And you summarize a lot of things as a consumer that we can do, mainly to reduce what we're getting in the first place, so to make sure that there's less waste in the first place.
So, like, where do you think us, like, consumers can go in Finland and, like, buy secondhand clothes? Or you know?
So consumers can get involved in so many things right now, especially if you're in Finland. There are, first of all, if you want to just dispose of your garments, there are, OOF has collection bins, and there are boxy everywhere spread around that you can put your clothes in, which is not something that is happening in a lot of other countries. And then there is things like Finnish events that are going on. So there's something called Active Textile Society, which is just a six-month challenge. So it starts in January, ends in June, and then I think there's another round from June to December. So there they will teach you various aspects of circular economy, of how things are made and how you can take care of your clothes and what can you do and get involved in. If you want to get involved in activism aspect of it, then also you can maybe make a community there with your like-minded people. There is something called Repair Challenge that is ongoing in many parts. So you just Repair Challenge Finland, you type it, you'll find some initiatives ongoing where we'll just, I mean, there's one that is organized in our university, in Aalto University, for students in March and April. And there we are encouraging students to just get their clothes and maybe sit in a workshop sort of an atmosphere and do those things. Personally, there is something called the IKEA effect that can be like used here as well. So the IKEA effect, as far as I understand, it's something like if you make things yourself, you have more emotional connection.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you want to, they seem to be like, this is made by me, so it's the best thing in the world. So it's that idea.
I didn't know that there is a word for it.
Yeah.
So, makes sense though.
But yeah, makes sense.
For sure.
Maybe I've completely misunderstood the IKEA effect. But for clothes as well, like, I mean, I know that if I repaired my jeans, like the zipper was not working and then I was able to repair it and I was so happy. I saved money and I also was like,
It's very nice to hear that all these initiatives are happening in Finland, and I guess some of them might even be in other countries too, with these bigger kind of initiatives where they're trying to do, you know, get everyone involved across countries. And we'll be sure to add the links where possible so people don't have to remember so much information. They're very good and very good information. But okay.
They'll be in the show notes.
So. Yeah. And do you have a final take-home message that you want to give to our audience?
I am inherently an optimistic person, so I would say that things are not as bad as they seem. And just... like, don't buy things impulsively. Take a minute, Google things, or just look up some sort of brands that you want to be interested in. And you can make a change, because textile is one of those things that I have personally realized how much say consumers have. And if you tell consumers that these are things that are made with unfair labor and a child was exploited in these making, people don't want to put those things on their backs. I mean, if you can't afford it, you will make a better choice. It's not like asking to buy better food products, because things are like proteins are necessary and all those things are different. But clothes, yes, you need some garments that are a necessity, like your down jacket. But, but everything else is optional. So, yeah, take some time.
Yeah. Very nice message. So I think that's all we have time for today. So I just want to say thank you for taking the time to join us at the Science Basement podcast. And it has been really very interesting to learn about all the different textile recycling initiatives in your project and around the EU and the world. And I hope you enjoyed the discussion today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And as a reminder, keep looking out for our new episodes on the podcasting platform of your choice. I've been Rhianna Newman.
And bye, everyone. Sujay, again, signing off.
And this was the Science Basement podcast. See you in the next episode. Goodbye.
Bye. The Science Basement.